growing with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 and KSTE.com. Here is Fred Hoffman.
And a happy Sunday morning to you. Welcome to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE. Farmer Fred here, Fred Hoffman, UC Cooperative Extension, lifetime master gardener, garden columnist with the Lodi News Sentinel, the guy that does all the typing at FarmerFred.com, all the ranting at the Farmer Fred Rant blog page, at Twitter.com/FarmerFred, daily garden tips, lots of snark. The Get Growing with Farmer Fred Facebook page, where there is always a garden dialogue going on. Then there are things like, YouTube, Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok. Actually, I'm more frequently found on Amazon, I think, much to my own chagrin. But all of that with great gardening information for you. The tittering you hear in the background belongs to Debbie Flower, retired college horticulture. Maybe she's just drunk. I don't know.
I don't rant. I titter.
You titter, yes. The tittering Debbie Flower is
That's
with
me.
Us. Oh, I'm so glad you're here.
I'm happy to be here.
And I appreciate it. And we're talking frost and freeze tips because...
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Let me update the weather and see if it changed. And now it's going to be mostly sunny all week. Nope. Sunny today. Sunny on Monday, but breezy with winds as high as 32 miles an hour in Sacramento. 50% chance of showers Tuesday. 80% chance of showers on Wednesday. What about Thanksgiving Thursday? Showers likely with thunderstorms possible after 4 p.m. with a high of 48.
Wow.
And a low that night in Sacramento of 32. And lows elsewhere in Sacramento County, I've seen as low as 28 degrees predicted for Thursday night and Friday night. And a slight chance of showers Friday and Saturday, which means mountain travel should be very interesting.
Even Bay Area travel will be sloppy.
Yeah.
And crowded. This is the travel time of the year.
We are living the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles this coming week, I think, for the entire country, because it seems like every part of the country is going to get hit by some sort of weather.
Oh, boy.
So it'll be interesting. If you have to fly somewhere, you have my sympathy. But before
do your grocery shopping today because it's going to be messy the rest of the week.
Messy because people fighting over the last turkey?
No, rain, I was thinking.
Oh, okay. All right.
You know, that happened to me last year. I waited to get my turkey and it almost didn't get one.
Yeah?
Till Wednesday, the day before.
It got to the point now where we just order it, the meal, and just go pick it up on Thanksgiving.
I know people who do that as well, and I've debated it, but... I'm cooking.
Okay, good for you. How many people?
Just six.
Okay, well, that's quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, it's enough.
Yeah, I'll be with about 100 people or so.
But you're not cooking.
No, I'm not cooking, though. We're just going to party down at the rest home.
All right.
Yeah, all right.
Like it's 1999.
Yes. Well, actually, the music that they usually play in this assisted living facility for my mother-in-law, most of the music harkens back to my youth, which means, I'm not too far from this place now, am I? If the talent they're bringing in to entertain...
They want you to feel comfortable, so when it's your time, you will
yes, I can
join them.
I can rock around the clock
rock
there.
Rock around the clock.
Yes.
You dance?
No, I should learn to at least move by myself in a circle.
You and my husband can practice together.
I have a story. I'm not going to tell it.
Oh, no.
About my wife actually dragged me to dance lessons at a community college.
Okay, we talked about that, my husband and I.
Yeah. It was the most nerve-wracking experience I've ever had because I my logical brain would try to count and tell my feet what to do. Mm-hmm. Never succeeded. It got to the point I had to put a sweatband on because I was just sweating so much trying to figure out how to get the brain to communicate to the feet.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, not my forte.
I guess not.
No, it's... But I tried.
Yes, you tried. You made the effort.
I made the effort.
Points
I spent the day
for that,
there.
For sure.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes. All right. So anyway, it's going to be cold. It's going to be wet. And it all starts apparently Tuesday. So do things. I would think today because of how breezy it's going to be tomorrow.
Leaves are something people should start addressing if they haven't already. Because if it's going to rain, then the leaves clog up the drainage paths.
Right.
Whether you've got storm drains in the street, which my neighborhood does not, but my former neighborhood did. Somebody had to get out there. Obviously, it would be nice if it were the government, but they don't get everywhere. And clear out each drain so that the water will actually flow there instead of it being clogged by leaves.
Yeah, or even on top of the gutter, which I think is the responsibility, should be the responsibility of the person who lives behind that.
Yeah, because they're going to be the one that suffers. That's where the water's going to build up and flood the road.
And the part I hesitate to mention with all the falling leaves we've had lately is, how are your gutters?
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you really want to spend the day cleaning your gutters?
Yeah.
That's the job that more than often, as you get older, gets relegated.
There are some cool tools. My dad had them because he was old, to clean your gutter. There are scoops to clean your gutter, but there's also a thing you put on your blower that has a bend to it. And so if it's dry, you just run it down the gutter and it blows everything out of it. That one was cool.
Yeah. I guess it depends where the leaves blow to. If they just blow back up on the roof.
And then they slide back down into the gutter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I say, this is one of those. Because one time I was cleaning the gutters out, standing on a ladder, and the ladder was on the driveway, and the driveway was wet, and the ladder slipped out from under me. And somehow I wasn't injured. I fell.
Wow.
Landed on my back with the ladder on top of me.
Oh, my gosh.
And I got up. Which surprised me.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I was very lucky. And after that, I go, I'm just going to be doing this from the ground from now on.
Mm-hmm. Which is why that blower thing, my dad had a two-story house, so cleaning his gutters was something I had to do, and it was difficult.
Yeah, so gutter cleaning might be on your list of things to do. In the garden, my neighbor loves me. My neighbor has a big pin oak in her front yard. And I've been taking all the leaves from it. Mm-hmm. I have been raking her leaves, putting them in a metal trash can.
And hauling them to your house?
Sticking a weed whacker in the metal trash can, grinding them up, and putting them on top of my raised beds.
Yeah.
As a winterizer, if you will.
Yeah.
And
I have a pin oak also. Boy, they produce a lot of leaves.
Yeah, they do. And this one's only half done.
Mm-hmm.
So there'll be plenty more to come. So that's one use for the leaves.
Right. And you need to check plants. If you have something that's dropping leaves like a tree, and there are other plants, shrubs, I'm particularly thinking of woody plants on the ground underneath it, if those leaves get trapped up against the trunk of that plant and then it rains, then that plant will suffer because it'll have moisture trapped against its trunk.
Oh.
So you may need to, it doesn't have to be today if you don't mind going out in the rain, but pull the leaves away from that trunk. Make sure that it's exposed.
Good idea. And that doesn't take much. Just a rake and move it 5 feet or so away from the trunk of the tree. And heavens knows with wind, there could be leaves piling up against trunks.
Yes.
Of trees. So, yeah, that would be a good step to take. Mitigating leaves this time of year is always interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And wet leaves are certainly heavier than dry leaves.
Mm-hmm. And they suffocate things. That's the other thing is I have pelargoniums under my pin oak I have true geraniums under my pin oak and the leaves fall on that and then they get wet and then they plaster down the plant. So I need to go out and shake those leaves off before the rain comes.
Okay. You just added to my list of things to do because my front yard is obviously covered in pin oak leaves as well from my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sort of let those leaves stay because it's a naturalized garden.
A few is fine. But when you can't see the plant or can barely see the plant, that's how it is under mine.
Yeah. And even though it'd be much easier to take a blower to that area and blow the leaves off, does that damage the plants?
It can. The air coming out of a blower can be 200 miles an hour, and that dries them out, beats them up. But if that's the way, there's something, maybe you know more about this than I do, in the male genetics that makes blowers very attractive and almost meditative. If my husband's going to go out and blow the leaves off the driveway, I just have to direct him where to blow them to. And
why? Where would he blow them to?
Well, he was blowing them. The lawn is his. Everything else is mine in the yard. So he's blowing them off the lawn onto the plants around the lawn.
That would make an interesting divorce. He gets the lawn.
He gets the lawn and the blower. I get the rakes.
Yeah.
So, trying to point out places where he could put those leaves that would not be damaging. But I'm happy for him to do it.
Yeah.
I'm happy to get it done.
Well, if the leaves are on the lawn, why not just run over the lawn with a lawnmower?
Well, I don't mow my lawn.
Well, he does.
No, nobody mows my lawn.
Oh, you've got the no-mow lawn,
right.
The mow-free lawn. Yes, which basically is cut once a year with a weed whacker.
Right.
Did I tell you I took mine out?
We said you were going to because your doggies were making it all yellow.
Well, apparently dog urine and this particular fescue variety, clumping fescue.
Right.
Fescues
in general are clumping, and so if you kill the clump, then you got a big hole in the lawn.
Yeah. So I planted it with Carapia.
Oh.
Carapia is a ground cover related
like Lipia.
Right, mm-hmm. That supposedly has a neater growing habit. So it's kind of just sitting there now, but everybody tells me, oh, it'll take off come spring.
Puppies get stung by bees when the Carapia is in bloom.
Well, they'll just have to deal with it.
Okay. We'll see.
Yeah.
Tune in spring.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm wondering because of the amount of shade in that area, how much they would flower. So
you might mix it with creeping red fescue, which is a shade-loving, more drought-tolerant.
But then I'd have to mow it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Carapia, you don't have to mow.
Yeah, but it wouldn't get tall enough. So you'd mow tall, and you'd mow the fescue, and the Carapia would be among it. It'd be meadow-like.
Yeah.
You got to like that look.
Well.
It's kind of a messy look.
I want to see what the Carapia will do on its own.
Sure.
And how it survives the dogs.
Yeah.
So we'll see. So it's basically 250 square feet of Carapia.
And then we were talking while we were off the air about building structures to hang grow lights from.
Yeah.
You could put that over your lawn.
Neighbors would like that, I'm sure. What's that purple light from the farmer's yard?
Yes. I had grow lights in my bedroom as a teenager, and my bedroom was painted.
No, you didn't have grow lights.
Yes,
you had black lights on a Janis Joplin poster.
No, actually, I had fluorescent lights.
Okay.
But four plants. They were hung over my... I had shelves, and I had plants. And my room was painted lavender in a shiny paint, sort of a dark lavender. So it truly glowed purple from the street.
Okay. All right. Well,
I was known by the neighbors for that.
As the purple people eater?
Yeah.
All right. Debbie Flower is here. We're somewhere in all of this. We are offering you frost and freeze tips. And we'll also get into other things that might be bugging you, such as doing some fall cleaning, which is, remind me to talk to you about that when we come back, about I've been seeing all sorts of empty old plant pots around, and I'm thinking, you know how in spring you're always rushing around to clean these pots to prepare for spring planting. Well, why not do it now?
Right.
Yeah. We'll find out if I should do that or not, or maybe I should just do some mulching instead. We'll find out when we come back to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
Get Growing continues with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Welcome back. Debbie Flower is here.
Yep.
We're talking frost and freeze protection because it's supposed to get cold and wet for the coming week. How's your garden going to fare? Raking up leaves, I think, is a good tip.
Mm-hmm.
I like that because, the leaves can clog the gutter and they can also clog your plants,
right,
if you will. So it's a good idea then to do that work. And if you are going to be, excuse me while I take off this microphone condom, thank you. If you want to rake leaves, do it today, not tomorrow, because 30 mile an hour winds tomorrow.
Can you re-explain what you're doing with your neighbor's pin oak leaves?
Yes, I am raking up her leaves. She doesn't have a problem with that.
I wonder why.
And I'm going over there with a metal trash can, a string trimmer, and a rake.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it's really interesting, too, because it's a 32-gallon metal trash can. I fill it full of leaves, pin oak leaves, and then I stick my string trimmer down. It's a battery-operated or rechargeable, so it's lightweight.
Okay. Yeah.
String trimmer into the can, turn it on, wearing eye protection.
Yes.
And just grinding the leaves.
Yes.
And by the time I'm done, that full trash can load of leaves is now maybe one-fourth of the can.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the reason I'm doing that is by grinding up the leaves and then putting it on my raised bed as a topping for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Because the leaves are ground up, they will break down sooner, mm-hmm, feeding the soil.
Mm-hmm. And they'll probably lay flatter better. Maybe.
I don't know.
But yeah, they're oak leaves, and oak has tannins in it, and they take longer to break down. But yes, when they're broken up like that.
Yeah, and yeah. I'm thinking by March, they'll be mostly gone.
Yep. I got, when I lived in Portland, we could get deliveries of leaves, and like, I don't know if you're using arborist chips, that, you know, a big truck shows up, and a big dump truck, and dumps about 7 yards of leaves, in this case, in my yard. And I moved them one fall. I didn't have a very big garden.
What kind of leaves were they?
Everything.
Yeah.
People would sweep them to the curb, sweep their horticultural waste to the curb, and it would be picked up by the city and then delivered to those of us who wanted it. And so,
in the raw state or composted?
In the raw state.
Oh, that's
so it was a mix of all kinds of things. I probably put 15 inches deep of leaves on my garden, all the way around on top of the perennials and everything. By spring, I had, you could tell that there was mulch, but that's all. And I had the largest population of worms you'd ever want to see. Anytime I dug, I'd hit a whole bunch of worms. And I also had a bunch of new roses because there were rose okay, cuttings yeah. in it.
Well, that's it. When you get these loads from arborists, you could be getting all those liquid amber balls, for example,
yes.
which can sprout. Acorns, of course, which can sprout.
Right. I have a casuarina that came in a arborist delivery.
Would that be a mountain she-oak?
Yes.
Okay. And berries from, say, a Chinese pistache?
Yes, you can get fruit. Yep.
Yeah. So yep. there's a lot
I haven't,
of things.
I've been doing that, the arborist chips, for quite a while, and I haven't had a tremendous problem. You do get some seedlings.
Right. But they're manageable.
They're manageable. You just got to walk, your like you do for anything to maintain your garden. You got to walk the garden. You know, you get your favorite beverage and you just go all over the place, pull the things that you don't like, note the things that you do want to keep, et cetera, and it works.
I have put my request in to my favorite arboreal company to next time they're in the neighborhood chopping up trees to drop those loads off on my driveway, please, because I can move them. I got plenty of places to put them.
Yeah, I have a big pile from my
bless
valley
you,
oak that failed. Thank you.
It failed.
Yes, it was it was directly under the power lines, and it was shaped like a T. And so at the middle of that T, the middle top of that T, where two branches were together, there was expanding and expanding. You know, the branches were getting fatter and fatter and fatter. And then one day, well, it was 1:30 in the morning, my neighbor called. Said, did you know your tree just fell down? It had split right there at that place where the two branches went off in either side. So there's what's called included bark. Bark that's touching each other from two different branches, and it just got heavy enough that it failed. Had I had millions of dollars, I could have had an arborist, you know, on retainer, tending that tree and taking the weight off the ends. But it was pruned, it was about 80 to 90 years old based on ring count, and it was probably planted by, you know, a wild squirrel or something. Not intentionally bought and planted there. And so it was pruned all these years to keep it under the power lines. And that made it into a very strange shaped tree. So it failed, yes.
That makes me wonder about all those oak trees. I think they're along Garfield as you approach American River College that have been V-shaped underneath the power lines.
V is okay as long as... where the V originates, the bottom of the V, mm-hmm. as long as there's enough space between the two branches that they don't start pushing against each other.
Because you can see that in your travels as you go along, especially, I won't say urban areas, but suburban areas, mm-hmm. where old oak trees and other trees have been pruned into a V shape in order to keep them free from getting tangled in the wires.
That is better than trying to keep them under the power lines.
Yeah.
Because you make a lot of heading cuts, and regrowth from heading cuts is very rapid and straight up in the air. So you go right back into the power lines. If you do a V, if you clear out that center so the power lines can go through the center, then you don't have that issue. You do thinning cuts, remove the branches at their origin. That's a thinning cut. So do thinning cuts. of anything that's growing into the power lines, and then they won't grow back into the power lines.
But it takes regular maintenance to maintain that shape.
Yes, and the utilities, if it's thinning cuts, it doesn't take, you know, 5 years. Every five years would be fine. If it's heading cuts, you have to do it every year. That's one big difference. And the power companies hire people, but they don't necessarily know a thinning cut from a heading cut. I've talked to them because they come through my yard a lot to deal with these trees. And I have to teach them and ask them to use thinning cuts on my tree, not heading cuts.
Well, yeah, then you explain thinning.
Yeah, I have to explain thinning and heading. Yes. And I'm not always home when they come. So this tree has suffered a lot, and it finally gave up the ghost. And it's been chipped.
Well, people now want to know. Differentiate between thinning and heading.
A thinning cut is removing a branch at its origin, so where it comes off the branch that it is attached to. And that retains the natural growth of the plant, meaning that the new growth comes at the tips of the branches.
Okay. Thinning cuts would allow for better air circulation, more sunlight into the interior of the tree, and probably eliminate rubbing branches as well.
And those are things you would look for and try to eliminate.
Yeah.
But and it allows you to manipulate the tree to make it into a shape that it wouldn't necessarily want to be in the case if we're talking about power lines here. So making that V in the center. But the regrowth occurs at the tips of the existing branches. It doesn't come off where you removed the branch. A heading cut is sort of randomly cutting a branch. It's in the way. It's up in the power lines. You just
On your roof.
It's on your roof. You just cut it sort of halfway down to get rid of it. That destroys the natural shape of the plant, and it results in epicormic shoots, which are shoots that come from random places on the remaining branch. And so if you cut a branch in the middle, you will get new branches growing very quickly, and usually a mass of them, a multiples of them, out from just below the cut. So it basically grows back to the place you just removed the branch from. If instead you had taken that branch all the way back to its origin and removed it, then it would not grow back over in the place it was before.
So in other words, if you are removing that branch from the roof to keep it from rubbing against your shingles, you would take that branch all the way back to where it joins up with another branch.
Yes.
Okay. And that we see tree butchery, like what you're talking about as far as heading goes, on mulberry trees a lot, and in Arden area, the Modesto ashes. And it's just cutting a tree back to the stumps does the tree no good at all.
Right. That if done correctly, cutting back to those stumps that become fist-like at the end of the branch because they get bigger and bigger each year is called pollarding, and it's an art form. It's practiced a lot more in Europe than in the U.S., and it can be done on species that close their wounds quickly. Mulberry, platanus, sycamore, and sometimes liriodendron, tulip tree. But it has to be done. Once you do it to a tree, it has to be done every year. And it has to be done to the same place every year. And it can be very pretty. I saw a display of it at Epcot Center 30 years ago. And it can be very pretty, and it's used to put a lot of, like at a cafe, put a lot of trees. Mm-hmm. They do it at... there's a shopping center on Fair Oaks, west of Watt. I can't think of what it's called. There's a Talbot's there.
Where Scott Seafood used to be, maybe.
Yes, okay. Yes.
All right, okay.
And they've done it reasonably well to their parking lot tree. So it allows them to be grown closer together, but it does shorten the life of the plant because you're constantly removing the food-producing parts of the plant.
One place that does that with a degree of success, because they're always doing it, is in Golden Gate Park near the DeYoung Museum.
Uh-huh.
There's
yes,
a lot of
yes.
sycamore pollarding
yes.
there, platanus pollarding.
And you have to do it every year.
Yeah.
It's so you got disposal, you got to have the ladders, you got to have the tools, you got to have the people, and then you got to dispose of all that wood and leaves that you're removing.
We'll take a short break. When we come back, can we talk about cleaning plastic pots?
Oh, sure.
Okay, we'll do that when we come back to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
You're listening to Get Growing with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Along with Debbie Flower, Garden Grappler coming up in a few minutes at 11 o'clock. A chance for you to win a prize or two from the Farmer Fred Prize Closet. Clue available at FarmerFred.com. Clue available at the Get Growing with Farmer Fred Facebook page. And I bet you will have answers. I am confident you will have answers without having to do much research on this one. Email came in from Ed, our friend Ed, Ed Livo, talking about Christmas lights. We're talking about the benefits of using the C7 and C9 old-style Christmas lights.
And that they are difficult to get these days.
Right. And you use them to keep your, especially your citrus trees warm by stringing them through on cold nights and turning it on.
Right.
It gives off a little bit of heat. And he says you can still buy them at ChristmasLightsets.com. I wonder if Ed put that website together on his own. And now he's just marketing
it. How very entrepreneurial of him.
Yes, ChristmasLightsets.com. All right. And sometimes you can see them in hardware stores in the bargain bin.
Right,
too.
And you can probably find them used online in places there. I don't know. I haven't looked.
And you can find them in a big tangle underneath my house.
Yes. They were at my dad's house. I don't know where they are now.
All right. Another fall chore on your list of things to do, because when spring comes around, all of a sudden you're rushing around and you're starting to do things like, I'm thinking February and March, even though it's not quite spring yet, but you might be starting seeds of peppers or tomatoes or flowers or whatever. And so you start gathering up the pots that you left scattered around the yard. And then you remember the fatal words of Debbie Flower, who frequently says, be sure to clean out those pots, rinse them out, bleach them, because there could be bad things in there that would vector disease.
Yeah.
How do you clean pots? And this would be a good time. Would cleaning a pot now serve the purpose?
Yeah, generally, yes, it would. The thing that we're most trying to prevent is called damping off, and it's a bunch of diseases that cause the plants, the seedlings, it's when they're very babies, when they're seedlings, to die off.
We always thought it's from cold, wet soil.
Well, it's kind of warm, wet soil.
Oh.
You know, like, I mean, it would, like room temperature, wet soil.
Right.
Yes, that allows the funguses and bacteria to grow fast, and they eat the stem of the baby plant. And one day the plants look great, and the next day you come in and they're all laying down at soil level. The stems have apparently broken at soil level, and that's due to the disease eating the stem at that location.
And this could happen even though you went to the store and bought a soilless seed starting mix.
Right.
Because what's
the
in the
disease
pot?
Would be left over in the pot. And the way place it's left over is on a little piece of media from before, even soilless media from before. And so your cleaning right now doesn't need to involve bleach. It just needs to involve a thorough cleaning of getting all the media, all the dirt, so to speak, out of the pot, outside and inside. So a good soaking to loosen stuff up just in a big bucket, and then a brushing or a cleaning. You got to get in those corners and get it out of there. You can run them through the dishwasher, although I'd recommend rinsing them first. And that's kind of a waste of dishwasher space. And then letting them dry. And make sure there is no leftover media. If you can put your finger in and run it around and it comes out dirty, you didn't do a good enough job.
All right. So maybe even just using the jet attachment on a hose end.
Yeah.
Sprayer could.
Yes.
Especially if you soaked it before.
Right. I would still wipe them at some point, either to dry them off or to wash them, because it doesn't take a big grain of soil to introduce the disease into the pot. Just one little bit. And so you need to rub the whole inside especially and get all the little bits of soil out. Then dry them, stack them up. I store my stuff outside. The only time I really feel I need to use bleach to really have a clean pot is if I'm propagating something that's very drought tolerant. For whatever reason, they seem to be way more susceptible to fungal diseases at the germination time, probably because it's moist at the germination, the time the seed germinates and erupts from the soil. And that's not their favorite. It's not their growing condition.
Is that true with cuttings as well?
No, damping off does not affect cuttings. It only affects seedlings.
All right.
So it's only if you're doing seed work that you need to do this.
Okay. So for those of you that will be propagating actual plants, I guess it's not too late to do a little plant insurance, and that's another frost or freeze tip. If you're worried about losing, say, your geraniums or your pelargoniums, is to take cuttings now and put it in a soilless mix, like a seed-starting mix, and bring them indoors.
Yes. You can do that with your tomato, too, if it was a really fantastic tomato.
Yeah, I have heard that. Yes, we've talked about that on the show, too.
Right, we have.
Even though it's November, you could still do that and still be successful?
Yeah, it takes much longer now. I try not to do propagation after about October 15th until about February 15th. I've started seeds in the greenhouse in January, but the plants, as the days get shorter and shorter and shorter, the plants, even though they're seeds underground, even though they're in your house, they really don't respond. We need the days to start getting longer again. And they will grow. They won't die necessarily, but you have to be more persnickety about how you care for them. You can't overwater them. You can't underwater them, even though they're seeds in the ground. The temperature has to be right. You don't want too much humidity. You don't want just enough humidity. Because it's taking longer to go through the whole process, it actually can die faster.
And remember, too, that some seeds take longer to germinate than others.
Like pay attention to that.
Tomatoes versus peppers,
for
example.
Peppers tend to take longer.
Yeah, and that's why if you are going to be starting peppers from seed, a lot of people will start pepper seeds in late January or early February and wait maybe till mid-March or even early March to start tomato seeds, because a tomato seed can be ready to be planted in the garden about, 8 weeks or so after planting a seed. And that would be about the end of April, then, that you'd be...
Yeah, I tried, and it seemed to work, soaking the pepper seeds in hydrogen peroxide for about 10 minutes before planting.
What does that do?
Pumps oxygen into them. Hydrogen peroxide is H2O2. Water is H2O, so it has an extra oxygen molecule.
So straight hydrogen peroxide?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, because it kind of, when it hits water, it kind of bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, seeds have, the first thing a seed does to germinate is imbibe or absorb water. And if it's absorbing hydrogen peroxide, it's just getting an extra shot of oxygen. That is anecdotal. I don't have scientific evidence to back that up.
What seeds would you do that with?
I have only done it with pepper.
And
because I read it somewhere and we tried it and it seemed to work.
I read it on the internet. Must be true.
Gave us more even germination and it seemed to be sooner.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll try that this year. Mm-hmm. All right. There you go. Hey, we got tips for you. We'll have more after this break. It's Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
Get Growing continues with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Along with Debbie Flower, we're talking gardening, talking about frost in your garden, a little fall cleanup, some cleaning, mulching, drainage check. We talked about checking the drainage if you've got sewers out front and make sure the leaves aren't there.
Right.
Make sure your gutters are clean. And a lot of situations with gutters right now, it's not so much the leaves that would be in the gutter, but the debris that has fallen from the trees as far as seeds or pollen. And it just builds
all
up.
All kinds of stuff. Twigs.
And stuff rolling off the roof.
Yeah. Yeah. All kinds of stuff in there. So... yeah, if you're going to get on a ladder, please have someone hold the ladder. Someone else be there. So it's a two-person job. And ideally, you want to look in there, see what is in there. See if you're getting it all out and flush it. But a lot of our systems now don't go, you flush them and you don't see what comes out the other end. It goes underground.
Right.
So you don't really know if it's working or not.
And that just might add up. Do some clogging underground.
Underground, and then it's a bigger problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I noticed the firms that do this for a living, cleaning gutters, they're not washing the stuff down. They are using vacuums up on the roof.
Uh-huh, the reverse, sucking it out.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Yeah, it is.
I don't own such a vacuum, though. Do you? If you're going to do it yourself.
I mean, I wouldn't want to play with a shop vac on the roof.
No,
myself.
Right. Right. Neither would I.
But I think there are. In fact, they do have leaf blowers with a reverse that would do the job. But again, I wouldn't even want to be on the roof with a leaf blower.
Right.
I've tried that, and it's a little unstable.
Right. So that's what my dad had, this attachment to the leaf blower that was several feet long, and then it bent at the end. Mm-hmm. So you could walk around on the ground and have that bent end in the gutter.
Blowing it all in your face.
Yeah, it was lots of fun. You could only do the first floor gutters, too. But
yeah, well, yeah, there's that. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I think as far as gutter cleaning go, I'm not that thrilled about these gutter guards.
I have not had them.
A lot of people have them in my neighborhood, and I've noticed, yes, it does keep the leaves out, but the little debris.
The fines,
yeah. Especially if you have a composite roof, that grit still gets in there.
Right.
And needs to get cleaned out.
Right.
So it's like...
It's a job.
Yeah. So it's up to you. $10,000 for complete gutter guard systems, or hire a firm to come in for $200 and, you know...
Do it once a year.
Do it once a year.
Yeah.
Or twice a year.
Yes.
Whatever. All right. So we've talked the cleaning, the draining. Any other place we need to check drainage? Soil.
Well.
If it rains. Well, I know where I'm checking drainage is underneath my house, but yeah, that's a different story.
Mine goes to my driveway and then down my driveway. And we started to realize that it was then going over into the neighbor's yard. And that's actually illegal. You mm-hmm. can't have your runoff go into your neighbor's yard. So I don't have storm drains at the street, but we did have to dig just in the soil a gutter, so to speak, on the side of the driveway so that the water would go all the way to the end of the driveway. And we had to build a little berm at the place it was breaching and going into the neighbor's yard and take it out to the street and let it run down the street.
To another neighbor's yard.
Yeah, I don't know where it ends up when it goes, because it goes downhill. Water flows downhill. I wanted to make a rain pond, a place.
Hmm. Okay, a swale.
A swale where that water would collect, yeah.
I thought you had one near your house, or was that an unintentional?
That was unintentional.
Okay.
When we had some palm trees removed, the house had, when we moved in, it has drains and an underground piping system. To collect the rainwater that comes off the roof and take it away from the house. And then we had some palm trees removed and the stumps ground. And apparently, we didn't realize at first, that ground the drainage system as well. So now the water was collecting, was stopping and backing up.
Yeah.
And it was ending up in my vegetable garden, which would be several inches underwater. We figured it out. There are very few people who will work on drainage, and they're very expensive. But we got the job done. We got a pipe put in, reattached to the system, and taken all the way out to... It doesn't go all the way. It goes halfway down the driveway, and then it daylights. And mm-hmm. so it adds surface water to the driveway drainage water.
Yeah, as long as it's going downhill, you can have that surface drain.
Right.
So that works. Yeah, we had that in Herald. And it worked like a charm until a gopher decided to live in the drainage tube. And then it backed up into the garden. And then we had to bring out the plumber with this extra long Roto-Rooter type machine.
Snake, yeah.
A snake. And it was really exciting to watch. I was watching at the surface drain mm-hmm. to wait for the clearing. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it was like Old Faithful with this gopher body going about 30
man.
Feet in the air with
oh.
all this water. It was beautiful.
Oh, I want a picture.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. So anyway, drainage, where does the rain go? You have to ask that question. If you've lived on your property any length of time, you have a good idea. And one thing you need to do, especially with the rain that may be coming this week, is it's only an inch, and usually the first rainfall of the season gets absorbed fairly quickly.
Yeah.
It's more the rains we're going to be getting in December and January, where you have to watch for puddling occurring in your garden. And maybe mark those areas with a stick or something to let you know is don't plant anything there
right.
that doesn't like wet feet. That if you want to plant, say, a cherry tree, that wouldn't
right.
be the area for it.
Right. I have this is something I do. And right now is a good time to go out and buy some really thin, maybe foot tall stakes, wooden,
mm-hmm.
and a marker, a permanent magic marker, a Sharpie or so. And so when you have a puddle like that, you write puddle and stick it in the ground. But those are also very useful for if you want to plant something, I need color here, or I need to move this plant, or moving is typically done in fall, but things you see in your garden that need to be done, but this isn't the season to do them, you pull out a stake, you write on it, you stick it in the ground.
Oh, good. And put on there what you want to plant there.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, because we will forget. It
happens to all of us, yes, over time.
As any gardener knows, sure, you can use that plant marker that came with the plant and stick it next to the plant, but the worms are going to move it someplace else.
And the cats are going to step on it, and it's going to break with the sun.
Yes, and it's going to get buried by the plant eventually, and right, you'll never find it again. So you write it down in the house in a garden diary.
Yes.
Which can be just a simple notebook about what you planted, where you planted it, and when you planted it.
I have a spreadsheet.
Good for you.
That's what I put in.
Right.
When I got it, where I got it, its scientific name, common name, sun, water, notes, you know, yeah, flower color,
yeah,
and where it is in the yard.
There you go. I use a loose leaf notebook as long as you've got evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You could also take a picture and put that in there, too, in this day and age. We have to take a break for news. When we come back, it's Garden Grappler time. Giving stuff away. Clue available at FarmerFred.com or the Get Growing with Farmer Fred Facebook page. It's the Garden Grappler coming up as we continue with Get Growing on this November the 24th on Talk 650 KSTE.
You're listening to Get Growing with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Welcome back. It's Garden Grappler time, a chance for you to pick up a prize or two from the Farmer Fred Prize Closet if you're up on the plants that will brighten up the gray days ahead. Now, you may recall last week, the Garden Grappler question was, name a plant that blooms in November or December normally. This question is a little bit broader than that. Name a plant that will add color to your garden during the gray days ahead of late fall and winter. Who wants to look out at tule fog-infested Sacramento and just see gray? You want some brightness, something that catches your interest because it has a little bit of color. But unlike last week's questions, it's not just blooms. There are other things that can add brightness to your life in the way of plant material. I hate the phrase plant material, but plant material that may have, interesting bark or maybe some sort of berries or something that catches your eye. Name a plant that will add color to your garden during the gray days ahead of late fall and winter. First five callers win a prize. Bonus prize for caller five, because as you know, in the Garden Grappler, you cannot repeat an earlier answer. Cameron, are you ready in there? He's ready. All right, he's ready to jot down names and numbers. We'll find out if we can get a winner. Five winners to name a plant that will add color to your garden during the gray days ahead. The numbers to call, 916-576-1578 or 866-331-8255. 916-576-1578 or 866-331-8255. Name a plant that will add color to your garden during the gray days ahead of late fall and winter. Debbie Flower is here. She will be the official judge and hanging jury for today's competition. I hope it goes better than last week, where people were naming plants that, shall we say, weren't timely in the way that they produced color. The question was, name a plant that blooms in November or December normally here.
Uh-huh.
I should have emphasized the word normally,
uh-huh,
because people were, anyway. I threatened to leave, I think. All right, so you do that. You know what I got to do? I got to open up this computer thingy here to make sure I see your names when you call. All right, people are calling. Good.
Good.
All right, in the meantime, let's talk about something where we won't give away answers.
Okay, we'll do our best.
All right, I guess the easiest way to do that would be to talk soil and soil amendments. That way we're not talking plants.
Okay.
When you rip out your plants of your summer garden.
We're talking my raised bed, my annual garden.
You pick it.
Okay.
What are you picking?
The raised bed.
Okay, the raised beds. When you tear out your the spent summer product, be it annuals or perennials or whatever, what do you do?
Well, the first thing is I noticed how much the media, and it is a mix of organic matter and field soil, how much it has lowered, has shrunk down. And that's because the organic matter that's in it has been broken down, consumed by microorganisms, the nutrients released to the plants, and that's what I want. But now that's already consumed. And so that means the bed has gotten tighter, the drainage has gotten poorer. My raised bed is pretty tall. It's about 30 inches, and it has an open bottom, so it drains right into the field soil below, which is why it's a mix of field soil and organic matter, because it is open in the bottom. So I need to loosen that media up so that the root zone drains better and add more nutrition. And the way to add nutrition is with compost, if you know good compost, with bagged goods like bat guano or chicken manure, and mix it in really well.
You have any thoughts of steer manure versus chicken manure?
Steer manure is mostly just organic matter. It doesn't have a lot of nitrogen in it. Chicken manure, you can smell it. Woo-wee!
Yeah. The cats love it.
Yeah, and so do the skunks. Yeah. Well, blood meal is even worse for them. I brought some bags of I have a hatchback car. I brought some bags of chicken manure home, and I had to drive around with my windows open for days afterwards because the car just smelled like chicken manure.
Yeah, you make that the last stop of the day.
Right, and come home quickly and yes. Get them out of there. Yeah, so the smell is the nitrogen in it. So it's much greater nitrogen content, so a greater source of nutrition for the plants. Nitrogen also, however, volatilizes, meaning it becomes a gas, and that's why we can smell it in the car. So it depends what you want. If you want lots of nitrogen, which causes green growth in the plant, then you want to put in lots of chicken manure. If you want need organic matter, and all soil problems are fixed with organic matter. So I would always advise adding some organic matter to a raised bed once or twice a year.
Adding chicken manure or steer manure in the fall, will that benefit a spring garden, or will it be all gone by spring?
The nitrogen will be gone by spring.
Hmm.
So you want to use the compost, the steer manure. Now they have stuff in bags, and they call it soil conditioner.
Yeah, yeah, whatever that is.
Whatever, exactly.
Yeah.
You can always, when you're buying, there are no rules by law about what people sell you in a bag. They can sell you anything in a bag and tell you it's anything.
Well, I would hope that the ingredients list is accurate.
Exactly. So flip the bag over.
Yes. Ha! Good luck on that.
And there is an ingredients list. Sometimes it just says things like forest products.
Mm-hmm. Forest byproducts. Yeah.
And that doesn't tell you much. If you're planning to start seeds in place, something to avoid is redwood. I wouldn't want to put wood amending means tilling it in, mixing it in, shoveling it, digging holes, double digging, getting this stuff down there. Mulching I still wouldn't mulch with redwood products if I'm trying to get seeds to germinate. There's something in redwood that seems to prevent seeds from germinating. Go into a redwood forest, see what's underneath the plants. It's difficult to get things to grow underneath redwoods. So I would avoid redwood products if I'm going to start things from seed directly in the bed. If I'm starting them in pots and putting it in the bed, then it's not a problem.
All right.
What do you do?
Well, I like to double dig with a spading fork.
Oh, you're a glutton for punishment.
I know, but raised beds are easy.
So do you stand in your bed?
Yes, I do.
Ooh, feet in the bed.
I mean, I walk backwards.
You walk backwards, You don't walk over what you shoveled.
No, you take the soil from the first two spading forkfuls and put it at the opposite end of the bed where you're going to finish up.
Okay.
All right. So then I just move backwards and pick up another load of soil, fill the first hole with it. Move backwards, pick up soil, fill it the hole in front, and just work my way back, doing it that way. Now, what I have done, though, before I'm digging, though, is I have laid on the top both chicken manure and soil conditioner, whatever that is.
So that's your organic matter.
Yeah, it's the organic matter. So I am mixing it into the soil, and I use a spading fork instead of a shovel just to avoid the shearing that shovels can cause.
Okay, so explain what a spading fork is.
Spading fork is a giant fork. It has usually three or four prongs. It can be from 3 feet tall to 5 feet tall.
Not the prongs, but the handle.
The handle, yeah, the handle. And if you have heavy clay soil, it's much easier to dig with a spading fork, and it tends to break up the soil better,
too. People can learn, when they're eating their mashed potatoes or mashed yams on Thanksgiving, yes. Take one spoonful, use a spoon, and then see that smooth wall left behind where you took the spoonful from. And then take a fork and take some, and you'll see it's not smooth. And that's it's ridged, because where the tine of the fork is, it took some, and where the tine of the fork is not, then it left more behind.
Right.
And that's good for preventing clods in soil.
And preventing maybe circling roots,
right.
too.
Roots are lazy, and they will go where it's easiest to grow, and you can actually glaze a soil by digging with a shovel, especially if it's wet.
Yeah.
That's another thing. If we're going to get wet this week, you don't want to dig right after the wetness.
Yeah, you don't want to be stomping around your ground either
when it's
wet. As I was saying earlier, though, because this is the first storm of the season, this water's going to get sucked up pretty quickly.
It is, yeah.
And you would only have a problem if you're doing it during the rainstorm or a day after, I think.
Right.
After a couple of days, the surface is going to dry out pretty quickly.
Give it a chance to drain. Yeah.
But if we truly have 5 days of rain ahead of us on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, mm-hmm. then, well, by Sunday, it could still be kind of mm-hmm. squishy.
Yep.
So basically avoid squishy soil.
Right. What kind of shoes do you wear when you're digging?
Old shoes.
You don't look for anything particular in the sole? Anything stiff? No boots?
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, I could wear what was those Australian boots?
Blundstones.
Yeah, Blundstones. Yeah. Except they have ridges in the sole, which can hold the soil.
Yeah,
and so then
really
I get in trouble going back
don't
in the house.
Don't come in the house, Fred!
Yeah, exactly. So I try to wear a smooth sole shoe, hence old shoe, mm-hmm. that I keep out in the shed.
Mm-hmm.
So my shed shoes.
Mm-hmm. And you step on it with the ball of your foot, not the arch.
Step on what?
The fork? The fork.
Oh, yeah. 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 You step on the front
of
your foot.
I'm just tearing this whole process apart into little bits,
okay.
Analyzing it.
Yeah, okay. It's not perfect, but it works. I mean, double digging, there are those who say, well, you're destroying earthworm habitat by doing that. Haven't you heard of no-till?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like to incorporate it into the soil. It's a raised bed. It's an artificial planting media to begin with.
It is. And no-till relies on cover crops, really.
Yeah.
To because the roots themselves then make the holes in the soil and incorporate the organic matter. The roots are the organic matter.
Right. And as we were either talking about off the air or on the air, I can't remember anymore.
Right.
when it comes to cover crops, I got to wonder, in raised bed situations where you want to be able to use those raised beds in March, your cover crops are just starting to grow then, really.
Right.
And so you have to wait.
But it is good. So you prep your soil, and the very last thing I would do is put a layer of organic matter on the top. Bare soil gets really beaten up by weather, by rain and wind. Water drops can compact bare soil. And so to protect that soil, I would put a layer of mulch on the surface. I do, however, have a bare spot, an unmulched spot in my garden for insects that need to nest in the soil.
Like native bees,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good idea. And usually when I'm done double digging, I will top it all with the shredded leaves.
Yes, perfect.
How does that increase worm populations?
Worms' favorite food is leaves.
Yeah, but where do they come from?
Well, if you've ever had a worm bin,
mm-hmm.
if you've had it, done it, not been the best worm bin owner, I speak from experience.
Me too.
So the population gets bigger and it gets smaller.
Mm.
And so they reproduce when conditions are good and they die off when conditions are bad.
Well, good. Now I feel better about putting all those leftover ground up leaves in my worm bin.
Yeah, they would love that.
Okay, well, hopefully that will boost the population.
Right. It's amazing. It's amazing to me. You think they're all gone and then you put, you correct whatever's wrong with it. And back they come.
All right. Oh, we have five people lined up, five people
Hot
who
dog.
Say they can name a plant that will add color to your garden during the gray days ahead. So we'll take a short break when we come
back. Wait a minute. They can add or...
Name a plant that will add color.
That will add color. Okay.
To your garden.
So they don't have to add the plant.
No,
it just will be colorful.
It'll be colorful to stand in contrast to gray, foggy days.
Okay.
Even though here we don't have as many gray, foggy days as we used to have in the wintertime here.
Right.
We still get a few.
Okay.
So it's
just needed to clarify.
Okay. And it can be a flower. It could be bark. It could be berries.
Right.
It could be, what else could it be? I guess a variegated leaf.
Bark, berries, yes.
Okay.
Leaves.
Mm-hmm. Name a plant that will add color to your garden during the gray days ahead of fall and winter. We will get your answers when we come back to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
Thanks for calling 1-800-GOT-JUNK. This is Sarah. How can I help?
You know.
Get Growing continues with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
All right, let's get some winners here in the Garden Grappler. Name a plant that will add color to your garden during the gray days ahead of late fall and winter. Debbie Flower is the official judge for today's competition. And the first caller today is Michael in Fairfield. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Fred. Hello, Debbie.
Hello.
Hello. Well, my... habanero pepper plant looks like a beautiful Christmas tree at this time, and I have a lot of them on there, so I don't think I'll be pulling them all.
Okay.
Are you going to keep it outside or bring it inside?
Oh, it's outside.
All right. Now, you know, when temperatures get down to 32 degrees, that and peppers don't usually get along.
Well, that's something I don't know, because it's the first time that they've grown so well.
Okay. Well, yep. Well, you'll find out.
Yeah. It will. You may, with the cold weather, when the temperatures are going to be, probably below 40, you may want to go out with a light sheet or a very thin, like, kitchen towel and cover it and have that cover touch the ground through the night, because it'll buy you a couple of degrees. It won't last, the plant won't last all winter, but you'll buy some time with that.
Okay, there you go. A spicy Christmas tree, the habanero. Yeah. Michael, good answer there. I'll be sending you, what do we have for everybody today, Fred? We have Farmer Fred's Fall Garden Checklist and How to Grow Edible Flowers in Your Garden, written by Sacramento County Master Gardener Gail Potthauer. Good answer, Michael.
One more question, please.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah. You remember how you were saying how people were going to be eating tomatoes on Thanksgiving. Well, my tomato plants are growing wild, you know. I guess it's going to be the same thing when it gets cold. You know, everything is going to start dying off. But, you know, we get this first rain. I guess we're going to see how they do.
Well, I think by Thursday, the really cold nights aren't until Thursday night and Friday night. So, yes, for Thanksgiving, we can all have a fresh tomato salad.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Michael. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. All right. Caller number two in today's Garden Grappler. It's Mark in Rockland. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
We are doing fine. What plant will add color to your garden during the gray days ahead?
Sure. My favorite has always been Nandina domestica. Mm-hmm. It seems the colder the nights get, the more brilliant the colors turn. Mm-hmm. And then I've always been amazed in the spring how the color goes back to more of a kind of a greenish yellow colors, and maybe you could explain why that happens.
Yes, maybe you can explain that, Debbie. I often wonder. Nandina domestica is the heavenly bamboo, and it changes color.
Right. It does change color
without dropping off leaves.
Cold leads to slowing down of everything in the garden, the funguses, the bacteria, the plant itself, and so the roots are not as able to absorb nutrients so not necessarily able to bring up the nitrogen that they need to keep them green. That usually leads to yellow. But then some plants make red. Red is made from sugar stored in the leaves. And red actually, it's a pigment. It has a name. It's called anthocyanin. So it's another molecule that gets in the leaves. And that... adds chemicals, adds stuff to the cells, and it actually protects them from cold. So the more stuff you have in a cell, if you think water and you add salt to it, it has to get colder than 32 degrees to freeze. You add more salt and it has to get even colder than that. So if you think of the anthocyanin and the pigment as the salt in the cell, the more pigment you can get in that leaf, the more cold that leaf can take before it freezes. So it's an adaptation that has been selected over time for the plant to live through the winter.
Oh, very interesting. Well, thank you for explaining that. I've always been curious about it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Mark, I'll be sending you the Farmer Fred Fall Garden Checklist and growing edible flowers in your garden.
Wonderful. And thank you both for the wonderful job you do. It's much
thank
appreciated
you.
every Sunday. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Remember us in your will, please.
Will
you.
Do.
All
will
right.
Do.
Good deal.
He sounds young. I
yeah,
think we're going to
yeah,
be gone.
Yeah, I know. Robert and Lincoln, go ahead. Give us one of those Grade A plants.
Hello, Fred and Debbie. How about manzanita?
Because why?
Oh, because the red bark.
Okay.
And the leaves are silvery and green.
Contrast. Okay, yes. They're all different kinds of manzanita, and some are kind of boring in winter, but yes, they have beautiful bark.
Yep.
So if you're in the foothills especially, you may be surrounded by it naturally, or you can plant your own. But yes, you can have ones with gray leaves and ones with really beautiful, it's just gorgeous bark.
Is that an exfoliating bark?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and that adds to the charm.
Yeah, it does, yes.
Yeah. Good answer, Robert, so I'll be sending you stuff.
All right. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for calling. All right. Who's up next here? Let's go to Pam in Lincoln. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Hi. So, Pam, go ahead and give us a plant for gray days ahead.
Christmas cactus.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
But that's
mine's blooming right now with pink flowers.
Indoors, right?
No, it's outdoors.
It's outdoors in a pot.
The house. Yep.
Yeah. Are we counting things in pots, Fred?
Why not?
Okay.
Yeah.
Mine are too. I was just telling him on break that I have a whole collection and I've gotten pieces from all these different people. And so in each pot, it's the name of the person I got it from. That's what I named them. Yes.
It's amazing how it knows to bloom on Christmas or Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving, yes. Right.
I know.
Or from Thanksgiving to Christmas.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just got it at a grocery store like a couple Christmases ago. You know, a little one,
mm-hmm.
container, and I stuck it outside and it just did fine.
Great.
That's called luck, Pam.
Yeah. don't leave it out in the very cold.
What temperature should you bring it in at?
Pot. What can I? It's a huge pot that I could not carry inside.
Do you know any football players?
Well, then no. Cover it when we're going to be at freezing or below, cover it up.
With a sheet?
A sheet, right, all the way to the ground so that it will trap some of the heat. It made it through last winter?
It did.
Wow.
It was a fairly mild winter last winter.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
I tried to keep my tomato growing all year, though, and it died.
This isn't Southern California.
No, yes. It isn't.
All right. Hey, Pam.
Go ahead, Fred.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Where am I going? Good answer with the Christmas cactus there, Pam. Thanks. And I'll be sending you the fall garden checklist as well as growing edible flowers.
Okay, great. You guys are one of the highlights of my Sundays. So thank you for your show. Oh,
well, thank you, Pam. Appreciate that. And you too can remember us in your will. All right. Please, folks,
okay.
Remember us in your will. All right. I'm begging of you. All right. Who's caller five here? It's Debbie in Oroville. Debbie.
Hi.
In Oroville. Why do I think you already have a Master Gardener garden guide and calendar?
Because I might have one.
Okay. I bet what you don't have. Do you still use postage stamps?
I really do.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Old-fashioned.
The U.S. Post Office just released a very colorful array of cactus blooms.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
And they're gorgeous, and I'll send you a goodly amount of blooming cactus stamps.
If
you can name a plant for the gray days ahead, if it isn't a habanero, a heavenly bamboo, a manzanita, or a Christmas cactus.
I just bought some red twig dogwoods.
Oh, yeah.
I'm hoping that that'll give me a contrast.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have snow, but they'll still have, you know, little sticks of red out there in the yard.
Right, they will. Yeah, we grew them at American River College.
Are they pretty?
Yes, they're sort of a green and boring green shrub most of the year, and then they lose their leaves and they have green stems, and then it gets cold and the stems turn red.
Hmm.
So you'll want to back it up to plant it so that behind it when you look at it is some contrasting color. Gray would be great, or a light color of your house, or something like that to really okay. show off the color.
Should it be a lighter color or a darker color?
I like it against a light color. Huh, but, okay. you know, personal preference.
All right. Red twig dogwood. Good answer, yeah. Debbie. So I'll be sending you from the U.S. Postal Service their latest array of horticultural-related postage stamps, which happen to be blooming cacti.
Thank you. I have a question if you have a moment.
Sure. We're not going anywhere.
Okay, great. I was reading in a magazine about bulbs mm-hmm. and that you have to refrigerate them for 8 to 10 weeks or something before you can plant them. Like, I don't know. Is that true? Like,
depends on the bulb.
Yeah, different bulbs. Some bulbs, tulips, for instance, most tulips, there are a few species tulips you do not have to do that with, need to be refrigerated. And I would only do it 6 weeks.
Okay.
8 to 10, it seems extreme to me.
Okay.
And you got to watch them, make sure that they don't dry out, make sure that they don't mold. So sometimes mixing them with some peat moss, because peat moss has a very acidic pH. It doesn't need to be damp, but acid reduces the mold growth, the ability of mold and bacteria to grow. I wouldn't do it in plastic. I would do it in maybe a paper bag or a net bag like you got your potatoes in. But daffodils do not need the cold treatment. What else does, Fred? Hyacinths do.
The hyacinths do.
Yeah.
Well, I accidentally refrigerated them for probably 4 weeks or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then I planted them. And then I learned that when I read, I thought, oh, my gosh. And I looked one. I kind of dug one up and it has little roots on it.
They will grow. Hyacinths, I had some in my garden in El Dorado Hills. And they will grow and they will bloom. But each year, the bloom gets shorter and shorter and further down in the leaves. And then eventually they just peter out.
Do I have to dig them up every year and refrigerate them?
Yep. Or buy new ones.
So should I dig mine out of the ground and refrigerate them three more weeks or something? Or
they're starting to grow. I think I'd let them go.
Yeah.
And then let them go through their process, bloom, have leaves, let the leaves decline. And once the leaves have declined, then dig them up, clean them. You want to get as much soil off as possible. Put them in. Some people put them in a box with peat moss or sand. I like peat moss for the reasons I stated. And then refrigerate them, yeah.
There you go. But Debbie,
pardon me?
We have to run.
Okay.
We're running horribly late. Thank you, Debbie. All right.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. And Debbie Flower, thank you for joining us here.
Always a pleasure.
Maybe come back in 2020.
Oh, I could do that.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I would appreciate that.
Thank you, Fred.
All right. You're welcome. When we come back, we're talking generator safety. Yes, more and more people are buying generators for very obvious reasons. We'll tell you some tips on making sure it runs okay when we come back to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
You're listening to Get Growing with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Well, a lot of people in Northern California now own generators when they've never owned one before. Whether they're city dwellers, suburban dwellers, maybe they've got an urban farm, maybe they're a farmer in the country, you may have a new experience on your hands running a generator during these power turnoffs that are being instituted throughout Northern California, where when it gets windy, the power company is saying, let's shut off the power for a while. And a lot of people, as a result, have bought a generator. But there is some advice you should have that may not be in the literature in that generator that you should know about. We're talking with Chris Kaiser. He's the president and CEO of the OPEI. That's the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute. And Chris, let's talk about generators, and let's talk about something that you're very familiar with when it comes to small equipment like this, is use the right fuel.
Absolutely. Key to any engine device, and in particular small engine equipment, is the fuel. And so if you have the right fuel and you make sure you've got, you know, your filters are clean and your oil's clean, an engine is nearly indestructible, a small engine. So that's key. If you have fuel, the engine's going to run properly. And nowadays, fuel will stale. The government got involved. Congress now makes us put ethanol, it's an alcohol, into fuel. Fuel will stale. It'll destabilize. It will no longer stay fresh. You hear a lot about stale fuel. The key is to stabilize it or use it frequently. Don't let it sit longer than 30 days. And in particular, if you're in a hot, humid environment, ethanol and alcohol is hygroscopic. It'll absorb water. absorbs enough water, it will phase separate, which means it frankly won't fire in the machine. So it's critically important to have fresh fuel. And the generator, it's advanced planning. Make sure, you know, give the engine a trial run. Make sure you're going to run it before you need it. Make sure you have adequate fuel, fresh fuel, and you can stabilize your fuel. So if you go into a dealer or a big box store, you'll see fuel stabilized, and it's right there on the can to deal with the ethanol issue, which will help keep that fuel fresh.
Yeah, one thing we didn't touch on, the fact that generators are four-stroke engines, the fuel and the oil are added separately into this, just like your car, but that oil in a new generator needs to get changed something like every 50 or 60 hours, otherwise you're risking damaging that generator, so have some spare oil on hand.
It's not an expensive investment, but it's a time investment, something you simply have to watch and be familiar with. The absolute needed maintenance for the unit. The unit will last for a good long time if you treat it well. And so what you've just described, make sure you watch your oil. And again, your manufacturer, these units are different. They're small ones. They get to be very large ones. It will speak to how often and what kind of oil to use. But you brought up a critical point. Oil is key. Oil is the lubricant of the machine.
And I would think, too, that when you're done running the generator, if you can, run it until it's out of fuel after turning off the electrical load in the house. Or, barring that, at least turn off the fuel between the tank and the lines.
That certainly helps. And certainly, if you're going to put it up for season, that's the one thing about a portable generator or seasonal equipment, emergency equipment, rarely used stuff, is you don't want that fuel to sit. Buy it and burn it is sort of the new words of the day. But what you've just described is what you need to do. You just think that machine's going to sit for a while, run the fuel out or drain it.
And you mentioned ethanol. Let's talk a little bit about that since people are going to be seeing more and more of it in the future. And ethanol and small engines aren't really a very good combination, are they?
That's true. And by law, I mean, small engines are regulated by EPA and the California Air Resources Board. Like other engine products, designed for a certification fuel, which has a set amount of ethanol. But what you can find today are fuels in the marketplace for which outdoor power equipment, and in particular non-road stuff, so snowmobiles, boats, generators, lawnmowers, chainsaws, all of that non-road stuff is typically not designed or built or warranted to run on anything containing more than 10% ethanol. But the government is allowing sales of E15 and higher fuel blends for a subset of the auto fleet, the flex fuel engine, but not for power equipment. It's specifically forbidden, and because it can damage or destroy it. And so we don't want you to lose an engine or have it damaged, so be sure to look for the ethanol content on a fuel pump. We're so used to looking for octane, right? A manufactured prescribed octane. But nowadays, you've got to also look at the ethanol content. Or you can buy, now it's oftentimes a little more expensive, but you can buy the canned fuel at point of sale, dealer or big box, and it'll be ethanol free. So you can buy it in all different sized cans, but oftentimes a dealer or a retailer will sell what they call a boutique or distributor fuel, which is ethanol free. And so you don't have those issues. They don't have those staling issues. I certainly use it for all of my handheld stuff. Now, if you've got a portable generator, you may be burning a lot more fuel. You're going to use a can, 5-10 gallons, what you've described is key. Stabilize that, and then you have much less worry. But remember, this is an engine. You wouldn't run your car in your living room or your garage or your breezeway. You don't want to run this engine indoors or near an open window or door either. They produce carbon monoxide. So it's critically important if you're going to run this product. Oftentimes, folks don't have long enough extension cords. They'll buy the unit, they're prepared, and they may have some extension cords, but they may not be weather-related, rated for the outdoors. They may not be long enough. What happens is that machine may get too close to an open window or door. So safety is paramount. It means you have to read your owner's manual. You have the right fuel. You have to have the right cords to stay far enough away from the house. One of the things, my family's down in hurricane land down in Florida, and one of the things we've learned is that once people are out of power, these things are critically important if you've got a medical situation or you're trying to preserve your food in your refrigerator and freezer. These things are very, very popular and sought after. And oftentimes in certain periods, they'll run out of inventory. And so people steal them. And so what happens is you may want to envision a scenario by which, you know, there could be theft involved. And so think about a way to secure your unit away from the house. And that's the problem. People bring them indoors or on the breezeway or into the garage to try to secure them. Don't do that. Figure out a different way. The last idea, we've also had people that they'll have the unit in a place they can only get to with power, say an electric door, electric garage door. Be sure that if the power fails, you can get to the unit.
Well, you brought up a lot of great advice right there. Let's wrap up a little bit on fuel, though. And one thing I learned while reading about generator care, it's always a good idea to not let the generator run out of gas while you are running it for electricity. That what you should do is turn off the electrical load, then shut down the generator before it runs out of fuel. Because of something called an economy voltage regulator, which will keep putting out power as the generator runs out of gas, but as the generator comes to a stop, the electrical load in your house can drain the residual magnetic field from the generator coils. The machine will start, but it won't generate power, which means you have to take it to a repair shop. There's something I never knew before.
Well, it's critically important. Again, you know your machine, right? You're reading your owner's manual. Obviously, it pays to keep track of the fuel that you're burning and the fuel that's left in the machine.
You mentioned that you don't want to be caught short with too short of an extension cord. What is the ideal extension cord? I would imagine something that's outdoor rated and perhaps 12 gauge.
Yes, heavy duty outdoor, 15, 20 feet, something that'll let you get it away from the house, because oftentimes, these are used in inclement weather, something that's weather rated and heavy duty. Again, it depends on the load. It depends on what you're going to hook to it. Portable generators come in all different sizes. So part of it is you need to know what you intend to run on the machine. What's its capability and what's the load you'll generate from the house?
Yeah, I think most generator instructions say don't run anything longer than 100 feet of 12-gauge cord from the generator to the appliance, because the voltage drop on longer runs could cause the appliance motor or compressor to burn out.
Exactly.
And probably another good tip would be to get a big plastic bag and put the original instructions in that bag and attach it to the generator.
Perfect. Absolutely.
Now, one thing that people may try to do, and it's a really bad idea, is to backfeed power into your house with a dual male-ended extension cord, thinking you can run your whole house with that generator. But then all of a sudden, you're feeding electricity back up the line, and that can cause a lot of problems.
Again, I'm not an electrician, but I've certainly been informed by them. This is something you don't want to do. You do not want to plug that generator plug into a house plug. It is ill-advised, and you could damage or destroy components, electric components in the house, things that use power in the house, as well as damage the generator. Don't do it.
It's going to be a part of Northern California life for quite a while, that generator, for every time we have a power shutdown because of high winds. We've been talking with Chris Kaiser of the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute with some good tips on maintaining and keeping that generator that you just purchased running safely. Chris, thanks for a few minutes of your time.
My pleasure. Stay safe out there in California.
You're listening to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
Get Growing continues with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Quick look at the weather ahead. Nice day today with a high of 67, low tonight about 39 here in Sacramento. Sunny tomorrow with a high near 63, but the winds are going to pick up with northwest winds to 23 miles an hour, gusting as high as 32. Now, depending on where you live, around northern and central California, those totals may vary. It could be even windier. However, checking the PG&E Public Safety Power Shutoff webpage, PG&E is saying there are no public safety power shutoff events forecast at this time. We'll take them at their word at this time. There are no public safety power shutoff events forecast for this time. All right. Tuesday, the rain moves in. 50% chance of showers after 10 a.m. Showers on Tuesday night. Wednesday, showers with thunderstorms. What about Thanksgiving, Fred? Showers likely with thunderstorms also possible after 4 p.m. And getting cold. The daytime highs, especially on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, will be in the upper 40s. And overnight lows are going to be near freezing or below freezing in some areas. Especially Friday night, it could be the coldest night. Thursday night, it's going to get cold as well. 32 is the expected low in downtown Sacramento Thursday night and Friday night. But that means in the outlying areas, especially in exposed areas of southern Sacramento County, the lows could drop down to about 28 degrees or so. So if you have frost-sensitive plants, citrus, you'll want to cover them. Chance of showers on Friday and Saturday as well. So it's going to be kind of a rainy period. We'll see how much rain, hard to say. National Weather Service at this point is predicting a half inch to 1 inch for Sacramento. Much more than that, though, in the foothills and the Sierra, with plenty of snow as well. So travel, especially around Thanksgiving time, is going to be tough through the Sierra. And for that matter, throughout much of California, this rainstorm is rather large and is going to cover most of the state. All right, garden events, what's going on? The Harvest Festival going on over at Cal Expo today from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's the West Coast's largest indoor arts and crafts show and a one-stop shopping destination with American-made, handmade, embellished arts and crafts at Cal Expo going on today. Up in Auburn, it's the Mandarin Festival going on today until 4 o'clock. The Mandarin Festival, the entry fee is, I don't know what the entry fee is, but the Placer County Master Gardeners will be there, and they'll be answering your garden questions as well as selling their beautiful 2020 gardening guide and calendar. The Mandarin Festival at the Gold Country Fairgrounds in Auburn at 1273 High Street. Going on today. The Sacramento County Master Gardeners have a beautiful 2020 gardening guide and calendar. It's available online. You can just do an internet search for garden guide and calendar, Sacramento Master Gardeners, and I'm sure the link will pop up. Or visit your favorite Sacramento County nursery, and they're sure to have copies of it for sale as well. Outlets such as Green Acres Nursery, Fair Oaks Boulevard Nursery, the Plant Foundry, Amy Ace Hardware, Tellini's Nursery, Soilborne Farms, The Secret Garden, all have it. And the same is true in the foothills for the Placer County Garden Guide and Calendar. Local nurseries in Nevada, Placer, El Dorado counties, I think Amador County, too, may carry the Garden Guide and Calendar. I can take a hint. Time for me to get on out of here, making room for the news, followed by the KSTE Farm Hour. And we're going to be talking about a new agreement with South Korea. They want more California rice. Well, who doesn't? There's help for farmers who are frustrated with paperwork associated with growing and marketing crops. There is a new CDFA grant that has money for various agencies to give farmers a hand in filling out all those bureaucratic forms. And we talk about upcoming food trends as well. We have weather, crop reports, and more coming up on the KSTE Farm Hour right after the news right here on Talk 650 KSTE. Back again next Sunday, December 1st, Don Shore from Redwood Barn Nursery in Davis will be our guest. Have yourself a great week. Stay dry. Have a happy Thanksgiving as well. Bye-bye.